So we can make the difference and just get the sound in place. This is screen 5 in utilities, energy, temporary activities, noise, and other miscellanea. Just provide provisions on this panel. Commissioner St. Clair. Ms. Scott.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and Commissioners. First, I'd just like to introduce Ms. Hopley, who's appearing with me this morning. The Council has filed opening legal submissions on Friday. I understand you have a copy in front of you. A case book's also been filed that includes the cases referred to in submissions, summaries from the Council's 4 witnesses have also been filed. I do apologise at the outset, these legal submissions do cover some issues that have been covered in other hearings. We've endeavoured not to repeat where possible, but there is some duplication, and I'll seek directions from you as to whether you would like me to speak to those points.
I'm quite happy for you to go over because we have a different combination of panels and not all commissioners have heard the other matters, and some of the matters need reiterating, I suspect, or discussing.
That sounds sensible, and I have endeavoured to refer back to the earlier submissions filed for completeness as well. So these legal submissions address the scope of this hearing. The Council's approach to deferral or transfer of submission points to other hearings, and the key issues on the 3 chapters. As per other opening submissions of the Council, these submissions don't respond to each and every issue that is remaining outstanding with submitters, nor within legal submissions that have been filed. But I do note there that they will be covered in the Council's reply, but the summaries of the Council's planning and noise witness has responded at a general level to the evidence of submission. The evidence of submitters that has been filed. And the purpose of that is to indicate to the panel the Council's position on that. And as you will hear from those experts, the Council does agree with some of the submitters' evidence that has been filed. I refer back to and adopt the opening legal submissions presented at the first strategic directions hearing in terms of Council's functions and statutory obligations, relevant legal considerations, and whether various submissions are on stage 1 of the proposed plan. We have attached to these legal submissions a summary of the law as to scope of submissions for the panel's convenience. In terms of the scope of this hearing, we have 3 district-wide chapters, and I note that that includes the definitions that are used in these chapters. And the definitions used are largely specific to the topics that are covered, and there have been some recommended changes to the definitions, and they are included in the revised chapters attached in Appendix A to each Section 42A. Although that, of course, doesn't mean that they would form part of the chapter, those definitions would remain in Chapter 2 of the proposed district plan. So the purpose of each of these chapters is that they regulate a specific set of activities and effects, which are generally distinct from the activities and effects regulated by the zone chapters. So that's the underlining zone. They apply across all zones within the district, except for the geographic area subject to Plan Change 50, and that is because all provisions relating to that area of land were formally withdrawn by the Council. Remarkables Park has sought clarification as to the application of all district-wide chapters to the Remarkables Park zone. The Remarkables Park zone, in terms of the chapter itself, hasn't been notified in Stage 1. and the council is in discussions with Remarkables Park as to whether that zone will be notified in stage two. Remarkables Park have, however, questioned the application of these district-wide chapters to that area of land as well. We have covered the council's position in the council's closing submissions filed in the subdivision hearing. And the council's position is that unless there is a specific qualifier in the district-wide chapter that says that the district-wide chapter doesn't apply to a specific zone, then it applies district-wide. And none of the three chapters before you have a qualifier, either an explicit or implicit qualifier in them that says that the chapters do not apply to Remarkables Park.
Isn't there a procedural fairness problem with this approach? If the council, or when the council notified the proposed plan, it was explicit that it covered part of the district, that some of the zones. It's not disturbing me. If a submitter was in one of those areas which was not covered in the first part, and it's not just Remarkables Park zone, the township zone is another one, how would they be alerted that they may be subject to new rules, even though their zone was not included in this part, and they have the opportunity to submit on those rules?
Yes, sir, there possibly is, and that turns to the notification and the information that was provided at the time of notification, combined with what is actually in the chapters. And it's clear that district-wide chapters were notified, and as you are aware, the planning maps that were notified did show the proposed zone chapters, and it also continued to show operative zones for the information of submitters. So when the submitters opened up those planning maps, it wasn't black and white in terms of, well, we've got nothing to do with stage one of the proposed plan.
Well, with respect to the title table, the index page identifies matters which are shown as operative and not part of stage one. So if one was to look at that and see that their zone was on that list, then they would take from that that they were not part of stage one.
If you just looked at the planning map legend, as we have previously addressed you, there are some inconsistencies in that legend that
hopefully they will be corrected.
Directors that require the submitter to look a bit further. But in terms of what is notified, the council's position is that it needs to be looked at as a whole. The legend and the planning maps is not a full answer, and the words in the district-wide chapter, there is nothing in there that says that they do not, that they apply only to the stage one zones. I do note, however, that the chapters as notified do not cover all stage two zones in terms of zone-specific standards, and this is acknowledged in the section 42A reports, and there are instances where, for example, Walter Peak, the special zone, they have sought for an additional standard. So they are a stage two zone. That submitter has recognised that it's a district-wide chapter and has sought that zone-specific standard be included in the chapter. The response in the section 42A is, yes, it's needed, but what is the appropriate standard is best decided when the zone is notified and the purpose of the zone is clarified and clear. So council accepts that an entirely consistent approach hasn't been taken to the notification of zone-specific standards within the district-wide chapter, and that is acknowledged.
Stepping aside from noise, looking for instance at the temporary building issue, the suggestion seems to be in the rules that they be dealt with in large part with the zoning provisions applicable. And from the section 42A was put forward, apart from matters of control. Is it the council's intention that apply also in places such as the township zone?
Sarah, do you have a question in about temporary activities or relocatable?
Well, it's in that chapter. It's relocatable.
Because the chapter, there's a different approach to those two types of activities within the chapter. So relocatable buildings are also subject to the zone specific standards, whereas temporary activities take precedent over
the other provisions. The relocatable buildings, zone specific standards. But is it the council's intention that the zone specific standards of township zone apply?
That is my understanding, yes.
Is that consistent with the operative regime?
I don't know the answer to that question, but I will speak during the adjournment and we'll be able to come back with an answer to that.
See, my concern is not so much for those submitters who have professional advice. I would expect professionals to read the plan comprehensively. My concern is more for the general public who may find the rules applying to them are changing without their knowledge or their ability to have any impact on them. That's my real concern.
Yes, I understand what you're saying, and
yeah. Perhaps if you could discuss it with more of the agenda, and we'll carry on with the rest of the time.
Just finally, going back to Remarkables Park Zone, as well as discussing with Remarkables Park whether the zone chapter will be included or excluded from stage two, council officers are also in discussions with Remarkables Park about the application of the district-wide chapters to that specific zone, but the consequences of doing that would need to be through a formal withdrawal process, and I cannot advise you anything further on that at this point in time, but the council's evidence and position has been provided on the basis that the district-wide chapters apply to the Remarkables Park zone.
Are you able to give us an indication as to when some formal outcome that would be
I cannot, but I can. I can seek an update on that.
Yes.
I would hope it wouldn't be 6 months.
Well, I'm just wondering because that will be before we provide our recommendations to the council.
Absolutely.
Yes. So we could take account of that.
Yes.
Yes.
I would hope it would be well
in advance. So we'll wait on that
question. Turning to section 4, here we address the council's approach to the transfer of submission points. We have included this section to assist the panel and submitters and to direct the panel to some of the to the examples that are not the ones that have already been addressed in the panel's minute relating to rezoning.
Just on this point, sorry to keep interrupting you, but I noticed without scanning rigorously through the appendix attached to the various reports, there was at least one that said it had been referred to the rural chapter hearings. And I just wondered if that had actually been deferred in sufficient time for us to hear that.
like the word transferred but I will check. I'm not aware of that specific one, but my understanding is that the consideration was, we've had this discussion earlier in the hearings process, and I will check, but there's certainly a procedure and process underway for that checking. Turning to paragraph 4.2, just to note the subparagraph A in relation to energy and utilities. Mr. Bryce, in his section 42A subdivision, has made recommendations on submissions relating to subdivision and development of land affected the national grid. Over the page, submissions relating to air shows at Wanaka Airport have been transferred to the business zones hearing, and that is consistent with the panel's minute that directed that the airport submissions on the rural chapter be reconsidered in the business zones, and I understand that the airport is comfortable with that recommendation. And submissions relating to the application of residential zone rules or standards to relocated buildings and temporary activities have been transferred to the residential zones hearing. Essentially, these submissions relate to the residential zone rules and standards, which are in the residential chapters. Turning to noise, that's subparagraph D, a submission of rural journeys. This relates to the Walter Peak Rural Visitor Zone. I've actually already addressed that this morning. The council has looked at the merits of this and considered that the content of the submission board is better addressed in stage two, once the purpose of the Walter Peak Rural Visitor Zone has been defined. So that standard would be notified in stage two and would go into chapter 36, notification.
Scott, sorry, just in relation to C with the residential zone and the relocated buildings, in particular there, how does it relate to the, we've already had the rural hearings, what if you're relocating a building within the rural zone, what about for commercial zones if you're relocating in there? I just wondered, why is it that it's transferred in this case, but what's happened if you're doing in these other...
I trust the answer is a simple one, is that submissions have been made on these particular standards, on residential standards. Some other submissions haven't been made in the context of relocatable buildings and temporary activities for the other zones. So there haven't been any submissions to transfer.
Thank you.
Paragraph 4.4, Skyline Enterprises Limited and Totally Tourism, they have proposed a new commercial tourism and recreation subzone, including an additional noise rule. The council's understanding is that the submitters would like their submission seeking that there be an additional noise rule heard in this hearing. The council advised the panel's decision on this matter. There are two obvious options. The evidence has been filed and it will be heard now. The second option, which would be consistent with the panel's minute that has been issued, is that the evidence could be deferred and heard as part of the appropriate hearing on mapping. And importantly, if the panel didn't accept rezoning request but saw merit in the additional noise rule, essentially sitting under a different zone name, then the panel can still direct or recommend that the additional noise standard come into this chapter at that time.
Does the council have a position on that particular noise rule? I took the trouble to read the environment court decision that Mr. Dent referred to in his evidence, where the court provided the special noise limit for that helipad, or as we now call them, in form airports. And I noted that the Environment Court said that it was only worthy of a 5-year consent. It seems to me that providing a rule in the district plan creates a right that lasts effectively for infinity. Albeit it could be reviewed in 10 years. And I wonder whether the council has a position on that.
Mr. Chair. Dr. Charles and Ms. Evans will address you on this in their evidence summaries. They have taken note of all the reasons you've just mentioned, and in addition that there is also a limit on the number of flights in the Environment Court's decision, and the position being promoted by the submitter doesn't include that additional limit, which is relevant to how the noise level was reached. And there's also an issue that they will speak to you about, which is whether, as drafted, that rule is limited to that specific operation, or whether the rule as proposed by that submitter would actually apply on a wider basis, which could have unintended effects. Finally, on this matter of hearing submission points, at paragraph 4.7, there's a little bit of uncertainty as to whether the submissions of Cadrona Alpine Resort Limited on the temporary activities and relocated buildings chapter, whether they are seeking a specific new rule as part of their rezoning request, or whether they're seeking changes to the notified chapter and the notified zone, which is the Cadrona ski area subzone. In any event, the council has continued to provide evidence on these submissions in this hearing stream. Okay, so turning to chapter 30, energy and utilities. Energy and utilities are fundamental to the social, economic and cultural well-being of the people and communities in the district. However, these activities also have the potential to have adverse effects on the environment, and as such, their appropriate management is important to the promotion of sustainable management of the district. In paragraph 5.2, I set out our relevant matters that must be had particular regard to from section 7 of the RMA. And in paragraph 5.3, I set out the purpose of the chapter, which is to provide for the sustainable management and growth of local, regional and nationally critical infrastructure and energy development in the district. Mr. Barr, in his section 42A, has raised a concern with the objectives and policies associated with renewable and non-renewable energy. And I note that the issue is limited to those specific objectives and policies. It's not chapter wide. Mr. Barr's evidence is that those objectives and policies could benefit from some improvement. However, there is no scope within submissions to make those changes. However, Mr. Barr has looked at the objectives and policies in the relevant parts of the strategic direction and landscape chapters, and in his view, they do provide sufficient additional guidance to decision makers on the protection of landscapes and amenity in the district. So as a result, although he has raised a concern that they aren't perfect, his evidence is that when read in the context of the whole plan, those objectives and policies are not so deficient as to be unworkable. We have set out the legal principles relating to scope, and as mentioned, they are attached in Appendix 1. And the paramount test is, of course, whether or not amendments are within the ambit of what is fairly and reasonably raised in submissions. Mr. Barr has looked hard to find a submission in which to link these changes to, and he hasn't been able to find a submission, and we're quite open that that is the position. And as such, the solution, if one is necessary, depending on the panel's views as to the merits of those objectives and policies, a variation would be required.
There's two. Firstly, there's a question. I'm just wondering, Greg, we have been advised at times of submissions that have sought the replacement of the relevant proposed chapter with the operative chapter. Is there a submission that seeks the replacement of the entire proposed plan with the operative plan? And I haven't troubled myself to look for that, but I'm wondering, because the amount of scope such a submission would create is rather broad.
Yes, I also haven't looked for such a submission, and if there was one, that does create a lot of scope. But there is also another issue of natural justice.
Yes.
And whether you could, in fact, reasonably expect to see such changes linked back to such a broad submission, that's also a relevant consideration, and we would certainly be wanting to make some decisions on that if there was an inclination to hang a change on such a wide, right, open submission.
Okay. The second question then is, would it be more convenient for the council if, after deliberating, we considered some changes are necessary, if we advise companies by way of a minute rather than waiting for the recommendation report to go to the council? Because that would be rather, as I understand it, may even be after stage two is notified.
Yes, the council would welcome that guidance on this particular matter.
There's nothing that chapters 3 and 6 in particular may now not resemble anything close to what they were as notified, and having made decisions on those strategic chapters, is there any way that we can link that through to now this chapter in particular, the utilities part? Because otherwise we're going to have completely conflicting, potentially, what's in the strategic directions chapter and what's in here now, and you've basically got a plan where it contains completely conflicting objectives and policies in two parts, which aren't we supposed to sort that out as much as we can?
In terms of the wider plan, yes, the recommendations for those earlier chapters are essentially in the panel's hands, based on the evidence that it has before it. And what the council is doing is presenting its position on the zone chapters and the district-wide chapters, which sit underneath the strategic chapters. In terms of Mr. Barr's concerns about these objectives and policies, it's really linked to them not containing the necessary qualifiers to appropriately recognise and provide for Section 6 and 7 of the RMA.
Mm-hmm.
So it relates to it relates back to those sections rather than achieving the higher order strategic direction and landscape objectives and policies.
Thank you.
Turning to temporary activities and relocated buildings, it's a mouthful. So these activities assist in the provision of the social and economic well-being of persons and communities in the district. However, they also have the potential to adversely affect the district's landscape and amenity values. Section 7 of the RMA provides that in achieving the purpose of sustainable management, in particular regard, shall be had to three relevant factors: the efficient use and development of natural and physical resources, the maintenance and enhancement of amenity values, and maintenance and enhancement of the quality of the environment. So this chapter has two distinct purposes. The first, to enable temporary activities, utilities and storage to be undertaken while managing any adverse effects on the environment. And I just pause there to note that the temporary activity provisions do take precedence over other provisions, except for three chapters: historic heritage, hazardous substances and signs. And the temporary activity provisions also trigger noise standards from Chapter 36. Second purpose of this chapter is to ensure that the external appearance of relocated buildings is compatible with the surrounding environment and amenity. And that purpose is focused on, and just to note there that the relocatable buildings are also subject to the zone standards. So that is why the purpose in this chapter is really focused on the external appearance of relocated buildings and the time period in which an applicant has to meet the standards which are set out in this chapter. One issue that is before the panel is the activity status for relocated buildings. The House Movers section of the New Zealand Heavy Haulage Association, as a submitter, has sought either that all provisions for relocated buildings be deleted from the plan or included within a committed activity framework. And in making its submission, the House Movers refers to a case in central Otago, which the submitter was involved in. In that case, the Environment Court upheld an appeal against a restricted discretionary rule framework and endorsed a permitted activity framework for relocated buildings, which of course included permitted activity standards that had to be achieved. The purpose of this point of the submissions is to distinguish the case. That decision did not seek to make a rule as to the appropriate method to regulate relocated buildings nationwide, and its findings in the circumstances of that case was that there was no evidence placed before the court to justify the imposition of a restricted discretionary framework for relocated buildings. The decision was influenced by the fact that the objectives and policies of the proposed Central Otago District Plan did not align with the Council's proposed regulation. And as previously submitted to you in other hearings, an Environment Court decision is not binding on the Council, which has a duty to carry out its own Section 32 analysis. Ms Banks, who is the author of the Section 42A report for this chapter, her evidence is that adverse effects can arise from relocated buildings beyond those that arise from buildings which are either built on the site or that are purposely constructed and transferred to the site in issue. And these include amenity effects associated with the time period for reinstatement works and the quality of the exterior finish, which are the two key matters that this chapter seeks to address. It's therefore the position of the Council that a controlled activity regime for relocated buildings is appropriate. This means that the consent will be granted, but provides the Council limited control over the recognised amenity effects of relocated buildings. And this controlled activity framework specifically reflects the proposed purpose of the chapter and the relevant objective and policy in the chapter. And that is really the key outstanding issue for that chapter. Turning finally to noise in Chapter 36. Section 31.1d of the RMA requires the Council to promote sustainable management of natural and physical resources through the control of the emission of noise and the mitigation of the effects of noise. Through Section 7 of the RMA, Particular regard shall be had to the maintenance and enhancement of amenity values and the maintenance and enhancement of the quality of the environment. So the purpose of the noise chapter before you is to manage the effects of noise in a manner that accepts noise as part of the environment, while recognising that noise can give rise to adverse effects on amenity values and the health and well-being of people and communities. At paragraph 7.3, I address here the relevance of stage 2 zones. The airports, Queenstown Airport Corporation, I'll just refer to it as the airport. The airport's evidence is that the council's routed process as to the management of the provisions of the noise chapter that relate to stage 2 zones is not clear. I have already spoken to you about this issue this morning. That is accepted to an extent in terms of there being a need to address some, but not all, stage 2 zones in stage 2 in terms of the standards that apply specifically to that zone, but that doesn't apply in terms of the district-wide rules and standards. And as already mentioned, this means that noise standards in relation to the stage 2 zones that are not currently contained within the noise chapter may need to be notified as part of stage 2 of the proposed district plan, and it is acknowledged that the council may need to initiate a variation in order to amend existing standards in the noise chapter to ensure that noise received in the stage 2 zones is managed in accordance with the relevant zone purposes necessary. Just in paragraph 7.3, there's a footnote there, 51. Apologies, the footnote is missing, but that is a reference to Ms. Kirsty O'Sullivan's evidence at paragraph 5.12.
5.12.
Turning now to table 2 of the noise chapter. So paragraph 7.6 of my legal submissions. Ms. Evans' evidence is that the notified version of table 2 of the noise chapter contains an error in column 2, which causes issues with the interpretation as to the operation of table 2. So the notified heading read activity or sound source. However, the table and the provisions within it relate to the receiving environment, not the noise generator. The intended application of column 2 is set out clearly in the notified advice note 36.3.2.7, which explains that the noise limits specified in table 2 are intended to apply to the zone in which sound from activity is received. And I'll set out there that advice note for your convenience. Also within this table, the word received is used throughout column 2 of table 2. And so the council submits that the correct heading in column 2 is zones the sound is received in. And the council's position is that apart from the issue raised by Ms. O'Sullivan for the airport, such an amendment will have no substantive impact on the operation of the provisions within the table. Ms. Sullivan has provided evidence that the proposed alteration to Table 2 would have the effect that activities within the Queenstown Airport Mixed Use Zone will be required to manage their effects on the adjacent zones. Yet there will be no requirement for users of adjacent zones to manage the noise effects of their activities on the Queenstown Airport Mixed Use Zone. And that is because of the notified rule 36.5.5, where there is no noise limit set out for the Queenstown Airport Mixed Use Zone. The council accepts that the application of 36.5.2 and 36.5.5 is in evidence. However, it is the position of the council that there is scope to resolve this in relation to notified rule 36.5.2 by moving this rule into table 3. and Ms Evans will speak to this in her summary of evidence shortly. In respect of notified rule 36.5.5, the council submits that the potential effects of the proposed amendment to the Collatu heading identified by Ms O'Sullivan is fanciful, and it is submitted that the clarification to confirm the intended application of the rules is neutral and there will be no clear prejudice to any party. Turning to the legal submissions of Remarkables Park of Mr Young, this relates to plan change 35, and clarification has been sought that the provisions in the noise chapter do not extend or abolish those provisions agreed to as part of plan change 35, which was the plan change relating to the aircraft noise boundaries at the Queenstown Airport. And his assurance is sought in relation to the Remarkables Park Zone. The council provided legal submissions on the relationship between Plan Change 35 and the proposed district plan in the strategic directions hearing, and that was through the legal right of reply. In summary, the panel is not bound by the environmental decisions on Plan Change 35 when making recommendations on the proposed plan, and it is entitled to recommend provisions in the noise chapter that go beyond Plan Change 35. So that is a matter of law. Despite this, the council has identified only two instances where the recommended revised chapter may not be consistent with Plan Change 35. Both of these matters are covered in evidence by the council. The first is the sound insulation rule in 36.6.2. The council has proposed that this rule be updated to refer to a specific double glazing configuration to reflect modern building practices. The second is the proposed update and consolidation of ventilation rules 36.6.3 and 36.7. And these recommendations have followed the expert evidence of Dr. Charles.
Just on change 35, how much of that can we take as being effectively operative, given the court's series of decisions and we still don't have a final decision?
Yes, I understand that it's held up by the Lot 6 component of the litigation. I'd just like to see clarification of that from Mr. Varger in the adjournment, but I can come back to you on that.
I think that is important. And there is the issue that we're going to have this to deal with this tomorrow morning with the airport. There's also the issue that the out of control boundary and the air noise boundary for Queenstown Airport shown on the maps are actually shown as being the operative ones and not part of the proposed plan, and that would be useful if we had an indication from the council before we heard from the airport how the council proposes to deal with that matter, because I'm sure it will be raised.
Yes. I'll come back to you on that, these instructions, but I do recall it may be addressed in the airport submission, but I'll need to check that. So back to the written submissions, paragraph 7.14. This is another structural issue that has been identified in the notified noise chapter, and it is 36.5.6 in the redrafted version, which is on page 6 of the chapter. So simply, this rule contains in Mr. Charles' evidence is deficient and unworkable. You'll see in the fourth and fifth columns the time limits and noise limits essentially double up.
Isn't there a simple answer to this? That the Kingston Village special zone as in part two, wouldn't we just defer that rule until stage two?
I like simple solutions, Mr. Chair.
And then
yes, but yes, I'd like to.
We can just treat that at the moment as not being. There are no submissions on it, as I understand.
That is correct, and that is the issue.
Yes, and it would be easier from our point of view to say, well, it's stage two, and we will just ignore it, as we would be tempted to do with all other stage two zones. And the expectation that the council will then, to the extent necessary, such as the industrial provider stage two, appropriate noise rules.
Yes, and the council officer intention is that they'll be re-notified at stage two alongside
yes.
The zones to improve this. In relation to Kingston Village, I appreciate how simple the solution is. I'd just like to reserve a response to that in our right of reply in terms of essentially ignoring certain provisions that haven't been submitted on and pushing them over to stage two. I'd just like to give that a little bit more thought in the context of the wider hearings. And that brings me to the end of my written submissions. I'm of course happy to answer any questions. And in terms of the order of the council's witnesses, we propose to call Dr. Charles first. His evidence is the only technical evidence. It would then seem sensible to hear from Ms. Evans on the noise chapter. And then I'm really in your hands as to whether you would like to hear from Ms. Banks or Mr. Barr first.
Yes, sir.
No questions?
No questions.
In terms of the information about hearing anything, I wish just the bits that need to be, should we get those? So that make it easier for us.
Yes.
If we could invite Mr. Charles, Dr. Charles.
Rules in the notified version of Chapter 36 will generally result in the same degree of acoustics immunity as the noise rules in the Oxford District Plan, and the majority of noise limits remain unchanged. These noise limits are slightly more stringent than guidance in New Zealand Standard 6802. However, they are consistent with some other districts, and I consider they should result in good residential amenity and provide protection from sleep disturbance. For the majority of noise limits, the only change in the notified chapter compared to the operative district plan is that they have been moved from rules for each zone to the notified district-wide chapter. I consider this move beneficial as it avoids inconsistencies and allows emphasis on the application of noise limits to zones where sound is received rather than from where it is generated. The measurements and assessment standards and acoustics units used for noise limits in the operative district plan were updated by Plan Change 27A. The majority of these have been rolled over into the notified chapter. I consider there to be several areas where the noise rules in the notified chapter could be improved, and I've detailed these in my evidence. Many of these matters arise from submissions and include changes to the noise rules, which are generally minor in nature. I also detail in my evidence several areas where I consider changes to the noise rules and submissions to be inappropriate. In my opinion, Ms. Evans, Ms. Banks and Mr. Barr have set out appropriate recommendations with respect to all these matters in their respective reports. The only area where I consider there to be an issue with the redraft of rules due to a lack of scope to make changes is redraft 3656, where the rule is flawed and unworkable with contradictory noise limits applying. I discussed below what I consider to be the key issues. Helicopters. There is no perfect method to assess and control helicopter noise in order to exactly account for its occasional short-term nature compared to other sound sources. In my opinion, the guidance in the relevant New Zealand standard, which is 6807, generally defines an appropriate noise limit which has been included in the notified chapter. This noise limit has been supplemented by additional controls on movement numbers in the rural zone, which is where most helicopter landing sites are located. I consider the noise limit for helicopters in the notified chapter to be appropriate without modification. Turning to submitter evidence, I agree with Christopher Ferguson that the EIC activity area of the Jack's Point zone should have the same noise limits as the village activity area. With respect to the ventilation rules proposed by Christopher Day, Sheridan Roberts and Kirsty Sullivan for the Queenstown Airport Corporation, I disagree there is any existing or likely future difference in ventilation system requirements in relation to town centres, airports or roads. I agree that the reference to G4 could be replaced, but I recommend the alternate requirement should be for at least half an air change per hour. I disagree that sound levels should be measured at 2 metres from a grill or diffuser, and I consider that 1 metre is appropriate. I disagree that using a heat pump should avoid ventilation requirements, and I disagree with Mr. Day that all references to sound should be changed to noise. The definitions chapter, as notified, states that acoustic terms should have the same meaning as in New Zealand standards 6801 and 6802. And in accordance with these standards, the terms sound and noise have generally been correctly applied in the notified chapter. Strictly, some instances of noise should be changed to sound, but I do not consider this materially affects interpretation of the notified chapter. Otherwise, the terms used are used correctly in the standards and rules.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions on your evidence. On page 16, the third to bottom line, talking about the noise effect from helicopters, you say generally from 500 metres above the ground. Wouldn't that be feet?
Apologies, that should be feet. Yes.
The second question relates to page 14, and so maybe a question from you or from Ms. Scott, talking about the Lake Hayes cellar commercial overlay. Perhaps I'll ask Ms. Scott, is that something we should be concerned with now or deferred until that is heard as part of the mapping issues?
Is the letter, I understand, sir, and I recall a panel was issued confirming that the paragraph in Miss Evans' section, I think it was 8.28, and the equivalent evidence from Dr. Charles would be deferred.
Right. Thank you. Now, while I'm facing you, Ms. Scott, in paragraph 8C of Dr. Charles' summary, he disagrees with the measurement point. And I'm wondering if you've had the opportunity to read Ms. Watt's submissions on this point, and whether you'd like to address us on those.
And yes, I have had an opportunity to look at them.
She suggests that there's no scope to reduce it to 1 metre.
Yes, so the notified provision states 1 to 2 metres. And my understanding of Ms. Walt's submission is that that gives you scope to move to 2 metres, but at one end of that spectrum, but not to move to 1 metre, which was the other end of the notified spectrum. With respect, I struggle to follow the logic of there being ability to go one way but not the other.
Would you like me to explain it? If the measuring point is 2 metres, that is within the range that was notified. No one thought that it be 1 metre or anything less than 2 metres. So the question is whether it is within scope for us to change it to 1 metre, given that submitters may well have been happy with the greater than 1 metre measuring distance.
Yes, and I think that's the key issue, is whether there's actually scope to amend the clause. And my understanding is there's a general, a wider airport submission, but nothing particular on that provision. And the experts have endeavoured to assist the panel by suggesting that the uncertainty by having a range is removed, and that you go either way, and clearly the two experts have a different an opinion about where you land. But the question really turns to whether you can change that provision at all, and I haven't had enough time to give that a lot of thought, and we'll address that in our reply in more detail. I'd like to read the airport submission again in full with that particular change in mind.
The other question is whether there would be any benefit in Dr. Charles and Mr. Day perhaps caucusing, albeit very on one small point, and discussing that matter as the technical expert rather than on behalf of their clients.
I'm not sure we're going to come back to you with 1.5 metres. Mr. Day thinks 2 metres, I think 1 metre. So I can explain in more detail why I think 1 metre is better.
Yes, certainly do.
So the ventilation system is installed so that you can close your windows, you can keep the airport noise or the town centre noise or the road traffic noise out of the room. In this instance, primarily talking about the airport noise. So that you can do that, you put in the ventilation system. What you don't want is the ventilation system then to wake you up, if the ventilation system itself is too noisy, so it's important that you control the noise from the ventilation system. Mr. Day and I both agree on what the level of noise should be, such that it doesn't wake you up or cause disturbance. And the question is the grill from the ventilation system more likely to be a metre from your head or 2 metres from your head? And in a typical house where a ceiling height might be 2.4 metres high, if you're sitting on a chair, your head might be 1 to 1.5 metres high. In my mind, you could quite easily be within a metre of a ventilation outlet, and therefore that should be the distance, whereas Mr. Day saying, well, more typically, you'll be at a greater distance.
If it's to do with sleep quality, which is how I understood you, characterised at the commencement of that, then people will be laying down rather than seated, won't they?
And you'll be a metre off the ground, yeah. it's sleep quality and amenity.
I understand what you're talking about. I stayed in a motel over the weekend that had a very noisy air conditioner in the bedroom.
there's not a scientifically correct answer. I mean, so ideally, you'd say this applies at someone's head position when they're sitting in their sofa or lying in their bed, which obviously wouldn't work as a planning rule. I've on the cautious side and said 1 metre. Mr. Day has gone in the same direction. The difference it could make, going from 1 to 2 metres, could be 5 decibels to the sound from the system. So reasonably
loud.
Reasonably significant change going from one to the other. So just to sum up, it's a judgment as to how far from the ground people think someone's head might be.
Dr. Charles, did you give advice to the council when the bill was drafted, or was it after it was drafted that you first saw it?
I think it was after it was drafted. It was carried straight through from the opposite plan.
Well, has there been any difficulties in the operation of it in the operative plan?
On the insulation rules generally, there have been lots of queries come through the consenting team in terms of how they're applied. I can't recall a query on the ventilation rule. The airport company reports some difficulties, but I can't recall something coming through the council on the ventilation rules. The ventilation, there's two instances when the ventilation rules get triggered. One is when someone builds a new house and they have to install ventilation. The other one is where the airport retrospectively fits ventilation. So under the plan change 35, within certain contours of the airport have to part fund or fund ventilation. And I think the airports have come across issues when they've been looking at installing ventilation rather than when there's new houses. In terms of queries coming through the council, which the ones I've seen on chosen buildings is generally from the new households. But they haven't, I can't recall something from the
Thanks, Dr. Charles. In paragraph one of your summary, you talk about the rules being slightly more stringent than the New Zealand standard, but they're consistent with other districts. Can you give us some examples of what those other districts applied this?
Yep. So for residential amenity, the New Zealand standards say 45 decibels at night, 55 decibels during the day. Queenstown is 40 and 50, so it's five lower. The lights, I think, Central Otago's 40 and 50. If you go around the country, about ballpark half the councils are 40 and 50 and half of them are 45 and 55. It doesn't actually seem to be related to the particular environments. It's just the way things have landed in the past and the plans are drafted.
In terms of your evidence summary here, in terms of the other evidence that's been presented or included from the other submitters, is it just the helicopters and the bits to do with the airport? Those are the only parts now where there are matters that are in contention between yourself and
The only other acoustic expert to submit evidence was Mr. Day from the airport, so there was only his evidence. I understand I'm talking to Mr. Goodwin, who helped prepare the submission for the Southern Health Board, that I understand had a mistake in the timing and they didn't manage to get the evidence filed on time, so he hasn't presented evidence to the panel. There's a number of other issues on noise that have been raised by planners, mm-hmm. the likes of Mr. Dent and so forth. There's no other technical evidence apart from the stuff from Mr. Day, but there's a number of issues that the planners have raised which do sort of stray into technical issues.
The redrafted noise chapter remains largely the same as the notified version, other than some general non-substantive amendments for the purposes of clarity and efficiency, and some amendments made as a result of submissions. Non-substantive changes include the amendment to column 2 of table 2 to refer to the zone the sound is received in, as opposed to the activity or sound source, consistent with the notified clarification 36.3.2.7. Consolidation of rules relating to noise from commercial motorised craft and relocation of the rule relating to state highway noise from near Jack's Point to the Jack's Point zone in line with other residential zones. Changes based on submissions include provision for sound from emergency and backup generators as a permitted activity, the addition of more lenient noise standards for parts of Jack's Point Resort Zone and Walsh Peak Rural Visitor Zone, removal of provisions for the industrial zones, the intention is that these be re-notified in stage 2, a reduced noise limit for frost bands that will more adequately control noise effects, provision for double glazing in relation to sound insulation, amendments to ventilation requirements within the out of control boundary and air noise boundary and the town centre and business zones, removal of the testing requirements for motorised craft, and amendments to the definition of notional boundary. In relation to the evidence of Mr. Sean Dent, I do not consider that an alternative noise limit to the recently consented helipad near the Skyline Gondola necessary. The helipad already has consent, which includes the noise limit of 60 decibels. If the panel were to overview to include a specific noise limit, I consider the rule should be amended to provide for a higher limit at the assessment location of 5 metres west of the Zitrek platform and not throughout the entire reserve. I do not consider the changes sought by Ms. Fiona Black to the noise standards in relation to vessels to be appropriate. If the vessels are low noise emitters, then they will comply with the noise limits, and if not, then I consider it appropriate to assess the noise effects of the vessels through the resource consent process. I agree with Mr. Chris Ferguson that the EIC activity area in the Jack's Point zone should be included in Rule 36.5.6, redrafted as 36.5.5. However, I do not agree that non-compliance with the limit should result in a restricted discretionary activity status, as this approach is inconsistent with the majority of the chapter. I consider that non-compliance should require a robust assessment and the application of the Section 104D gateway test. A non-compliance with a minor effect will pass both limbs of Section 104D with regard to noise. Therefore, I do not consider the non-compliant activity status to be too onerous. I agree that Mr. Chris Day suggested an amendment to clarify application 36.3.2.5 improves clarity. I accept that sound from an activity is not an activity. However, an activity status has been provided in Table 1 on account of the way that the chapter has been structured, and I consider that retaining the activity status provides certainty for proposed district plan users. On the evidence of Mr. Sheridan Roberts and the proposed ventilation rules, I agree that the building code needs to be complied with regardless of any provision in the proposed district plan. I understand from Dr. Charles that half an air change per hour will achieve compliance with G4 and therefore Roman 1 of Rule 36.6.3 could be amended accordingly. I agree that reference to heating could be included as this was in the notified version. However, I do note that the purpose of these provisions is to mitigate noise effects and provide alternatives to opening windows, which you would not do if you were wanting to retain heat. And I do not consider it necessary for a note to be included to specify that existing systems may meet the standards. Regarding the evidence of Kirsty O'Sullivan, I agree that the Remarkables Park Zone should be included to the list of receiving zones in Rule 36.5.2. I also acknowledge the structure of the table within Column 2 amendment does not work properly for this rule as it refers to the sound generator, Queenstown Airport mixed use zone, not the receiving zone. A solution may be to transfer this rule to Table 3. This will alleviate the structural issue with the table and ensure consistency with clarification 36.3.2.7. I do not agree that there should be separate insulation rules for town centres, as the requirements are generic and not specific to airport noise.
I suspect we will have a number of questions on this evening, so it might be appropriate for us to take an adjournment now before we do that, because otherwise we'll stop them with any questions.
Certainly.
So we'll adjourn until 11:40.
Thank you.